It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Coming up today, part two of The Political Editors. Lots of nice messages about the interview yesterday with Fred Emery. Today, it's a special interview because it's with Julian Haviland, who sadly died earlier this month. But I spoke to him only a few weeks before he died to talk to him about his time as political editor of The Times. Some extraordinary stories coming up, some extraordinary memories, even going back to Alec Douglas Hume. But also some extraordinary stories that he couldn't publish about the Queen. So that's coming up in just a moment. But first, let's take a look at the day's news with today's columnist panel.
The Columnists on Times Radio.
And we say hello to Danny Finkelstein, who's here in the studio. Hello, Danny.
Hello.
Good to see you. And Jenny Russell. Hello, Jenny.
Good morning.
Jenny, nice to have you with us. Let's start with your column today in The Times. You've been writing about crime and how shoplifting has been effectively decriminalised. Well, a few weeks ago, I had the Met Police Commissioner, Mark Rowley, in the studio on the show, and I asked him exactly that, whether he thought people had a licence to shoplift.
There's not a licence to commit any sort of crime. Of course, we do prioritise crime when we spend more time investigating stabbings than we do shoplifting, but nothing's licensed.
And yet, Jenny, the reality is you write in the paper today is a bit different.
Yeah, he's talking nonsense, basically. He has to say that kind of stuff when he's on the radio, but he knows perfectly well what the statistics are. I mean, the fact is that the British Retail Consortium, which represents about two-thirds of all retailers, says that they now are having about 8 million shoplifting offences a year in their shops, and yet, which has doubled in the past 6 years, and yet the number of people actually appearing in court on shoplifting charges is down by 75%. And in fact, that means that there just isn't any penalty for shoplifting, and shopkeepers are increasingly being told by the police, who won't attend any instance themselves, just to let it go. And so it means it's paying for things in shops has become voluntary, and that's absolutely disastrous.
Danny, what do you make of this?
Well, first of all, can I just say what an amazing column that is, Jenny. You know, sometimes when you write columns in a paper, you have a combination of feeling great, this really interesting thing's in the paper, you feel educated reading it, but also as a columnist, you think, oh, that's quite annoying because I didn't write it myself. And that was one of those columns. You're bang on. And actually, I'd just been hearing about this debate taking place in the United States where they've been taught, where some cities have essentially written off crimes below $1,000. And of course, lots of crimes below $1,000 are being committed with impunity. And you wrote about that really well in a British context, which was shocking and completely correct. And obviously, if you allow crime to take place at this low level, this is the previous discovery of zero tolerance policing. You will get crimes built on that. When the police in New York started to arrest people for jumping over the turnstiles in this subway, they found they were arresting people who had warrants out for their arrest for all sorts of other things, or had, firearms in their pocket. And if you do this, it's not just the crimes that you can see; it's all the infrastructure. You talked in your piece about gangs. You know, if you let a gang operate with impunity of that kind, it'll get bigger and bolder, and you only then stop it when it finally murders someone.
And I was really struck, Jenny, in your column, you spoke to your local shopkeeper. He said people walk out with things all the time, wine and bags of coffee and all sorts. And so he said specifically, when people steal things from his shop, the police never come, no action is taken. Even when he sends them to CCTV, he says, they tell me just to let them take it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the official advice, which is don't confront anyone. And as this poor little shopkeeper said, some of the people that he challenges have got knives strapped to their arms. He's not inclined to challenge them anyway. But the official advice is you can't do anything and you aren't authorised to do anything, and it would be dangerous to do anything, but we're not coming.
Can I ask you one question, Jenny, about it? Yeah. It was like very interesting. So there was one assertion you probably know, which is what's coming from me, given we've had this discussion before, which was about the funding of the police and austerity and its relationship with this policy. Well, let's accept, obviously, the more money you put into something, the more things the police can do. We don't need to get into the debate about whether we needed that policy or not. But do you feel that if the police reprioritised at whatever given amount of money they had, they would be able to deal with this problem? Is this partly an issue of priority with a lot of time spent, for example, on kind of, online non-hate crimes or whatever the phrase is? Or do you think it's just that they really can't cope?
I think it's a combination of both things. So I think you're absolutely right that they are being told to concentrate on other things, and I wish that they would leave a lot of social media alone. But I also and it's also signals from the government. One of the problems here is that the government in 2014 redefined shoplifting of anything under £200 in almost every case as a summary offence, which meant that both it could be dealt with by the magistrate's court, and somebody who pleaded guilty doesn't even need to turn up to court any longer. They can just write in by post saying I'm guilty, and I'll probably get a £70 fine. So that's if you're charged. And the consequence of that is that the police got the signal from the government that no one's interested politically in their pursuing an issue like this, and that it's not very important. Shops, equally, if they pursue any shopkeepers themselves in prosecutions, they can't get their costs back for any shoplifting of less than £200. So the police are being told it's not important. They also know that the courts now are so clogged up and there's such a backlog that probably even if they pursue anyone, it'll be a very long time before they go to court, and probably nothing will happen in the end. So I think there's a pervading sense of hopelessness. Now, if people were told, if there was a zero tolerance policing approach adopted in London, if people were told, yes, every crime matters, we start at the bottom. You discourage people from thinking that crime is fine, because as Danny says, correctly, once you start saying to young people in particular, you can steal and there will be no consequences, then they start building criminal networks on the basis of that. And they think, why should I stick to any other rules?
Jenny, I think that you put your finger on a very important point when you talked about the courts. An awful lot of, I think, the criminal problems of crime begin in the fact that we're underfunding the court system rather than the police.
I agree.
And I'm normally very resistant to saying we should spend more money on, because you can say that about everything, right? Because if you spend more money on things, you get more of it. I do actually think we've underfunded the court system, and you can see it creaking. And when you talk about making this a summary offence, that is basically a surrender because of the court system.
Yeah.
So I think if you can get that right, you're right. I think the police will probably adjust their behaviour. You know, Tom Whipple, our colleague on The Times, has been writing a series of articles and tweets about his bicycle that was stolen and how the police wouldn't pursue the CCTV. And when he finally got the CCTV himself, it was unusable. And he said that's why the police didn't pursue it. In other words, the police are not going to spend their time doing something they think ultimately will run into the sand or will be a summary offence. They won't do it. So I think if we can get that right, maybe that is the answer to, or at least some way of addressing the problems that you raise. But they're totally fascinating.
But all, I mean, the other element you sort of throw into this, because the reason we had Mark Rowley on a few weeks ago was I also went out with the Met for the afternoon in Peckham, and was out and about with two officers. Yes, we had a press officer with us, but they were pretty open about everything that went on, and they said they'd seen in the last year or so, as a result of the cost of living crisis, a rise in the number of reports of shoplifting. I suppose there's two things going on there. One is people who genuinely can't afford to buy things, but also the value of the things you're stealing now has suddenly gone up. That the, you know, wine has gone up, and, or meat seems to be stolen a lot. That's gone up. And so that's sort of feeding into as well. So you've got an already overstretched police force. People feeling the pinch might be more inclined to steal. The people who want to steal stuff for profit are more inclined to, because the things they can easily steal are worth more money, and then the courts can't cope with it anyway.
I bet there's another element to it, which is that the cost of living crisis, as well as giving people an incentive to steal because of the value of the goods, also kind of gives them an excuse to themselves for doing it, and makes people feel less bad about doing it, because they think, well, we're taking this money off rich big companies, and so who cares about them?
You can hardly see that, of course, of all the little independent local grocers, for a start. And secondly,
people do say that. So, that's what's so interesting about some of the kind of right. If you see that amazing Spike Lee film in which they end up bombing the pizzeria and the Korean superstore. And it was because those were, as far as they were concerned, the rich people in their area. So people sometimes overestimate the amount of money that some of these businesses are bringing in, and don't think actually these businesses are right on the breadline.
Yeah.
The other thing to bear in mind, though, is that the co-op, which is after all run for the benefit of its members and isn't making profits that go elsewhere, both co-op and John Lewis saying a lot of what's going on is organised crime, and the co-op says that huge amount of it is. So when you hear stories about people stealing meat or baby milk and you think, goodness, they just want to feed their baby. No, on the whole, they don't. What's happening is that thieves are taking things like baby milk and meat and coffee and wine because they're easily resellable down the pub.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely an element playing into that. Well, it's a cracking column, Jenny, as Danny said, and it's really good
to shine a light
on it. There we go. Let's move on and talk about, because we're sort of now deep into, I think the Greens today are selecting their candidate for the Rother Glen by-election. We're deep into sort of party selection season. Dev Hindry's written a piece for Conservative Home today saying that a trend's emerged, the Conservative Party's selecting very local people for local seats, Danny, perhaps more than normal. What does that tell us about where the Tory party is?
It's an incentive that people are under, particularly when they're under a lot of political pressure and where they think the national message may not be as strong as it was before, so therefore having people locally. And then there's just been a general trend towards it. And I think this piece is right to say that's slightly difficult. The Liberal Democrats had this issue where it was impossible to say which seats they would win, and therefore they would get a collection of local people. That's how Jeremy Thorpe ended up being leader of the Liberal Party. You know, there weren't very many MPs, and he was the most talented, but the fact that he was eccentric and, as it turned out, a fantasist and unreliable, that wasn't, it was important to the people who were selecting him, and he was an amazing candidate for his seat. So, I think it is an issue. And if we look at the last leadership election for the Conservative Party, with all, unfortunately, they hadn't necessarily filtered for quality. But nevertheless, one of the things that was encouraging about it was a lot of ethnic representation, which was a conscious policy of the centre to alter the distribution of abilities and qualities of their candidates. And I think the party has to engage in that all the time. As the centre of the party, you cannot abdicate entirely the responsibility for your candidate selection to local parties. They have to be strongly involved. That's vital too. But you can't just abdicate.
Yeah. Jenny, the counterpoint to this is I know when Rishi Sunak was selected in his seat, Richmond in Yorkshire, he was up against a very local candidate, Wendy Morton, who actually got selected elsewhere. And actually in their seat, because they'd had William Hague previously, Leon Britton, I think, had been the MP there before, they wanted someone who was going to be like a big figure. They actually didn't, there was some slight snobbishness about the local candidate. And actually, in a way, don't you want local associations to be like selecting the next prime minister rather than essentially a glorified sort of county councillor?
Yes, I would argue very strongly for that, because I think the whole of the country suffers when you've got politicians of very low calibre. And one of the problems for the Conservatives at the moment is, not least because Boris Johnson got rid of a whole raft of decent moderate Tories and expelled them from the party, you've got a very limited range of talent in the party, and we see the consequences. I think Suella Braverman, for instance, is totally not up to the job of being Home Secretary. But there's not much of a pool of talent beneath her. Shame that parties can't see beyond their own narrow constituency boundaries.
I mean, both Rupert Harrison and Nick Timothy, who are, you know, range at difference, of different areas of agreement and disagreement with both those people. They're very high quality people, both of them. So people can get selected, and it's very important that
they
are selected.
It's taken them a very long time, though.
It has, you're quite right. And I began to think neither of them would get selected, but it's interesting that they have been. And what's interesting also is that is not... What was interesting about that is they weren't local, but they also weren't ideological candidates.
Yeah.
You know, so Nick Timothy had worked for Theresa May, obviously, but Rupert Harrison had opposed Brexit and worked as chief of staff for George Osborne. So it is, I think that's at least a small sign of encouragement.
Now, talking of Rishi Sunak as we were, he visited the Busy Bee Nursery in Harrogate yesterday alongside Gillian Keegan, the Education Secretary, and the two of them were asked to draw a bee. This was the reaction.
Right. Yeah. Don't judge for her. There we go. There we go. Whoa.
Yeah, I think when the Prime Minister's there, you've got to clap regardless. I mean, he could literally have drawn anything. Well, how good was it? How does his bee compare? Tom Whipple's written in the Times today, it's short on legs, it looks like it would struggle to take flight, and it appears somewhat lacking in vision. No, it's not Rishi Sunak's latest policy proposal. It's the Prime Minister's painting of a bee. Laura Freeman is the time, his chief art critic, and joins us now as well. Hi, Laura.
Hiya.
So go on, how good is Rishi Sunak? If all goes wrong at the next election, has he got a future as an artist?
No, but my heart does go out to him a little bit. I mean, answering questions about the small boats policy while in a classroom full of three-year-olds while drawing a bee that will be held up to scrutiny by the world's media and their art critics, it's not an easy gig. I actually think his bee is better than Gillian Keegan's. You know, hers is sort of more convincing, and she's probably the better draftsman.
Well, it looks like a bee, Laura. Gillian Keegan's looks like a bee.
But I would say it's a very derivative bee. Okay. It looks like she's just copying a cartoon bee, whereas I feel Rishi sort of captured the very essence of bee. You know, it's sort of got, it sort of vibrates, it's restless, it's busy. It feels really like a real life bee.
Right. What did you make? What do you make of it, Danny?
I think it doesn't float like a bee and sting like a butterfly.
Jenny, does it matter? I mean, it is a sort of thankless task. Whenever a politician goes into a school, something happens. I mean, there's a picture of, was it Theresa May or David Cameron went to a school and a child sort of put their head on the desk? No good comes from, you know, never work with children and animals, Jenny.
Actually, it's one of the few moments that I've admired Rishi Sunak. I thought he was completely unembarrassed about his terrible bee. And I think Laura there was just showing the normal art critic's prejudice against representational art. Gillian Keegan's is a much better bee, because Sunak wasn't doing anything Picasso-like. He was just being incompetent, but sort of charmingly incompetent and unembarrassed about being incompetent.
It's a good point, Laura. Where do you draw the line between, talent, like genius, and just incompetence?
Well, I would take the view that if you're not terribly good, and I'm not terribly good, I can kind of just about, you know, wield a paintbrush, but you might as well do something a bit abstract expressionist, you know, if you can't do something that has much verisimilitude. And I feel he did that. It's sort of got a bit of a Munch feeling, a bit of a German abstract expressionist, a bit of Picasso, maybe a bit of Eve Klein in those blue waves at the top and the blue wings. But you know, in all honesty, no, it is not a contender for next summer's RH. Show.
I would undoubtedly have drawn a large letter B if I was asked to draw a bee. both because it represented my painting limitations, but also because it's just an instinct of mine to make a pun out of almost everything.
Exactly. Well,
I think that it, I think what it should do, Matt, is encourage all of us to get out there with a paintbrush, because it doesn't matter how appalling we are. It reminds us that it's just fun to do it.
Most of
us, if we're not good at it, we shouldn't do it. And actually, that's the wrong lesson we learned from school.
Danny Finkelstein and Jenny Russell. And of course, you can read them both in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. And if you're a student, here's some exciting news. You can now get a special student subscription to The Times. It's £9.99 a year. £9.99 a year. So if you've been thinking about getting a subscription for a while and you're a student, then you can get it £9.99 per year for 3 years. Just go online and subscribe right now. Right, up next, it's part two of The Political Editors Today with Julian Haviland.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
I don't think that other people in the world would share the view that there is mounting chaos.
Where there is discord, may we bring harmony.
We're all right!
It is time to put up or shut up.
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
This is a decisive moment for the world economy.
Now the decision has been made to leave, we need to find the best way.
Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed.
I have been repeatedly assured that there was no party.
Growth, growth, and growth.
Some mistakes were made.
Half a century of politics told by the people who wrote the first draft of history for The Times. This is The Political Editors. For this episode, Julian Haviland on making the journey from political editor of ITN to The Times, his memories of Thatcher, Wilson, Alec Douglas Hume, and a remarkable story about the Queen he never got to publish.
The Queen was watching this on telly, and when the horses went in and rode through some of the miners and knocked through down, the Queen said words to them, "Oh, that's awful." She took an extremely large scotch. Her husband, Dennis, was the one who said a drink like a drain. But Margaret had quite a capacity.
Now, this is a particularly special episode of The Political Editors because Julian Haviland died earlier this month, exactly a month after our interview. His career spanned a remarkable period of British history, and he was known for his exacting journalistic standards, his persistence and impartiality, but also for his affable and courteous manner, as you'll hear during the course of our interview. He started out in journalism at the Surrey Advertiser before moving to South Africa and reporting for the Johannesburg Star. Returning to London, he began his television career at ITN, first as a reporter, and then eventually, in 1975, he became ITN's political editor. He met every prime minister from Alec Douglas Hume onwards. But let's start with his thoughts on Harold Wilson, who first led Labour to a narrow election victory in 1964.
Harold Wilson was a lovely man. Tories thought he was damn clever, but nasty.
We've got a job to do. We can only do that job as one people, and I'm going right in to start that job now.
The truth is the opposite. He often made quite serious mistakes. As a human being, he's very warm and pleasant, and he once lent his house in the Scillies to Ray Gunter, who'd been one of the Transport Union representatives, and Ray disappeared because he had cancer. They spent several weeks. We now see what happened to him. One day, there he was back in the lobbies and spitting blood, almost literally. I said, Ray, what's up with you? Do you know what that little sense has done to me? That little sense is Wilson, who we hated. And he said, I said, no, of course I did. He went, he's lent me his cottage in the Scillies to get better, and has made a remarkable difference in my recovery. But and Ray was very upset because Wilson has shot his own fox, as it were, and so he could no longer go around saying what a swine the man was. And he came back to me after a few seconds and said, by the way, the little so-and-so says I mustn't tell anybody, so keep it to yourself. So I thought Wilson came rather well out of that. I don't think he was all that good a prime minister. He had his flaws. But as a human being, he could be quite delightful, and he was generous. I think not being Alec Hume helped, because he seemed more like an ordinary bloke. But he's quite clever at getting headlines, too, and he had a good staff around him who helped him.
There was Julian Howard in the View of Howard Wilson, seemingly a decent and warm man who made some poor political decisions. Well, it was certainly a far more favourable impression than that made by Ted Heath, who defeated Wilson to enter Downing Street in 1970.
He was as dour as everybody would think.
I never discuss personal matters, actually, yes, with my colleagues. I never have done.
He didn't often crack a joke. At least we did. It wasn't particularly funny. And he was not easily accessible to any except a few lobby correspondents. So I didn't think I can characterize him. He was a dull man, essentially. He did terribly well in life and in politics. But he had a few friends. Well, sadly, he was lonely. He was a bit solitary.
Julian Hammond's View of the solitary Ted Heath. Well, Julian also had a tricky relationship with James Callaghan. Before entering Number 10, Callaghan was Harold Wilson's Chancellor, but he resigned after being forced to devalue the pound. Wilson immediately brought him back as Home Secretary.
Speaking for myself, I think there's a lot to be said for the pound. Every one of us in Britain's familiar with it. We know what it stands for. Abroad, they know what it stands for. And it's as good a system as any other system you could find. So the pound and the penny, two old coins and units, they hold the day.
Callaghan and I didn't much get on. It didn't matter. Things got better after a bit. But when he had resigned at the time of the devaluation as Chancellor and became Home Secretary, he came to the ITN studios and he was so smug about it. He said, well, it was my duty to resign because I was Chancellor after all. And I thought it was time that someone took my place. And he was so smug, I couldn't help saying, well, you didn't do so badly, did you? Because you jumped out of the Treasury and you're now Home Secretary. And it came out ruder than I normally like to be. And he would have struck me if we hadn't been live on that. So we were never great friends, but I did admire him.
Julian Hammond recalling Jim Callaghan's decision to resign as Chancellor and explained the two didn't go on to to the point that he thought that Jim Callaghan might have punched him. Well, Julian Hammond was known well to the nation as ITN's political editor and trusted by politicians of all parties. He impressed by his reputation at Westminster, the editor of the Times, Harold Evans, persuaded him to make the unusual move from broadcast to print journalism in 1981 to become the political editor of the Times. Julian describes what happened in his typically crisp and succinct style.
I'd done quite a lot of time in ITN. I was enjoying myself, but I got a call out of the blue from Harry Evans, the Times editor then, whom I'd always greatly admired. And you don't turn down the offer of editorship at the Times or political editorship. So I didn't.
Yeah, you definitely don't turn down the offer of a job as political editor of the Times. And Julian threw himself into reporting on the difficult early days of the Thatcher government, regularly taking calls from senior ministers without having to ring them himself. But he didn't find the move into print journalism entirely straightforward. He was used to summing up stories in a few hundred words for a TV broadcast and now had to write stories that could be longer than 1,000 words.
The lead column of the Times, you had the lead with two columns, perhaps 1,500 words. And as the lead story on television would be 500-600 words if you were lucky. The great thing is they couldn't cut you off on telly. Once you promised to go from 500 words or no more, you were free to go and go and go and drive everyone nuts. Well, and Times was a person called sub-editor, still is, I'm sure, who had the last word. When I went to the Times, Ian Aitken, who I mentioned, was lovely, and I said, I'm not going to know how to film. Well, he says, it did easy, Joe. Never use one word, or 17 will do. It was a good rule, so I used to do 17 words in one.
Yeah, I'm sure the sub-editors loved you. Which do you prefer? Did you prefer working in TV or in print?
TV was easier because you were always, deadlines weren't so pressing. I was shocked by how soon, if you were going to make the front page, you had to have your copy in on the Times. Whereas with ITN, with the main news, as it always was, you could walk in at the last moment and spout, and as I say, never could stop. And so it was easier. And you thought the poor newspaper people are going to have to catch up because the events I'm describing, they'd have had to write about at 7 o'clock. And here am I with an update at 2:50. So telly was much easier.
Julian, they're summing up the differences between broadcast and print journalism. Although I have to say, I don't think I've ever been told at the Times, never use one word when 17 will do. They'll definitely cut that out. You are listening to episode 2 of The Political Editors and the final interview with the former Times political editor, Julian Haviland, who died early this month. Now, Julian spent the bulk of his career at Westminster from the 1960s until his retirement in the 1980s. I asked him which politicians he remembered as the most powerful speakers in the Commons.
I remember the ones who were genuinely eloquent, and so they had the potential of changing the outside's mind. Tony Benn was a very remarkable speaker.
We've tried to make capitalism work with good and humane Labour governments, and we haven't succeeded because it can't work, because it rests on injustice.
Brian Walden later became a television presenter. Those three sound. Oh, I had the most eloquent of all, a man called John P. McIntosh, who was Labour MP for the marginal seat of Berwick, and didn't last long because it was a very marginal seat. But he could hold any audience in his hand. And they're not people who made high office, but they're very, very competent speakers and good people. I remember them. I mean, the press gallery upstairs was empty. If the name Ben came up on the annunciator, as we then called it, Anchor from the more subtle, however, internal television. And everyone rushed down to the chamber to hear these people speaking. There weren't many of those.
Really interesting that the names Tony Benn, Brian Walden, John P. McIntosh were the MPs that would send journalists scurrying to the gallery to listen to them. Well, some of his favourite politicians, like any journalists, were the talkative ones. But sometimes they told him things he was unable to publish. This is Julian describing what happened when Cecil Parkinson, Margaret Thatcher's Trade and Industry Secretary, told him a story during the Falklands War, which Julian worried would put lives at risk.
I like the blabby ones, Is it so useful? And I sought out the discreet politicians. Sometimes they sought me out because they were kind of people who liked getting publicity. A very good example was Cecil Parkinson. At the time of the Falklands War, Margaret Thatcher had an inner cabinet, as you'd expect, of Foreign Secretary, Defence Secretary, Chiefs of Staff, and Cecil Parkinson, who was relatively inexperienced, his Secretary of State for Industry, I think. And she added him too. He had none, knew nothing about warfare or anything. She liked him. She thought he was a handsome fellow, which I dare say he was. And there came a time when I encountered him in the lobby, and she always wanted to talk to me, had something to say. And at the meeting that morning of the war cabinet, they had discussed, they'd heard that one of the farmers in East Falkland had rigged up a skywave aerial by linking his transmitter to the top fence of his paddock, and was sending back top-class information to the government about where the urges were, how many, what strength they were in, and said, well, that was a good story, as it was. And we were all, this is a time when the fleet, you may not remember this, Matt, they were in the South Atlantic on their way to Falklands, but none of us knew where they were or when or where they'd land. We were still under pressure from editors like my then editor, Charlie Douglas, to write a story about this. And you had nothing to say. You knew nothing about him. And he said, well, tell me this story. I thought, now, last I got a story. It was an hour before deadline. So I raced upstairs to the lobby room, Times lobby room, and before I got there, I suddenly realized I couldn't print it because the urges would certainly have spotted the man and he'd be dead within a week, short. So I ran down where Cecil had already found someone else, some white man, dead telegraph. And I broke the rule, which is that you, if you see a journalist talking in the lobby, you don't interrupt the conversation. If something confidential may be advancing. And I collared them both and said, look, Cecil, if you're just telling Jim, I suppose you are, what you told me 10 minutes ago, you mustn't tell him. And Jim looked puzzled, but then soon the penny dropped with Jim. It never did drop with Cecil. I said, if we print this story, we're sentencing this man to death. It's a good story. It's a pity to let it go, but we have to drop it. You know, people always say to you, a journalist will stop at nothing, totally unprincipled, will get any story out. This was an account, I think, of the fact that journalists aren't totally indiscreet. It was Minister was being indiscreet, and we were being rather good.
Amazing story from Julian Hamilton explaining that when he was the political editor of the Times, he didn't publish a story about a farmer in the Falklands transmitting information on the location of the Argentine fleet for fear it would put the farmer's life in danger. He had to try and stop the blabby, in his words, Cabinet Minister Cecil Parkinson from briefing other journalists on it. Well, senior journalists were always keen to speak to him as the political editor of ITN because they felt it allowed them to reach ordinary men and women. Margaret Thatcher was no different. Here is Julian interviewing her on the television in July 1980.
Prime Minister, I think people would expect me to ask you about unemployment. May I ask you first how much higher you think it'll go?
I don't know. I've never been a politician who forecast unemployment. I do fear it will go higher next month, and I fear it will stay high for quite a time, as it did on the last occasion when we had a sudden increase in unemployment. But I can't give you a maximum figure.
Well, a year later, Julian left ITN to join the Times as political editor, and he found he had to wait a little longer for an interview with the Prime Minister. Here's what happened.
And the time came when I last got an interview with her. I was told the Prime Minister would see me now, rather graciously. So I went along, saw her, and I hadn't seen her for a year, so he covered all the bases. And after he'd finished, she took an extremely large scotch Her husband, Dennis, was the one who said a drink like a drain. But Margaret had quite a capacity. So when I got back, Charlie Dove assumed that the editor, who was interested, said, how did it go? And I think I must have shaken a little bit, I said, with the falsehoods of my questions. Because after I finish, she had a very large whiskey indeed. And before I get my lips to mine, she was halfway through a second Meadows whiskey. So I must have made an impression. Charlie said, you fool, Julie. You've forgotten what day it is, haven't you? And it was Tuesday evening at 5 o'clock or what. And her next engagement was a weekly audience for the Queen at 6 o'clock. And the one person in the world of whom Margaret Thatcher was frightened was the Queen. And that's why she downed a lot of whiskey. And I flattered myself that she was nervous about me. Not a bit of it.
The Queen takes an intense interest in every aspect of life in our country. And she brings to bear a formidable grasp of current issues and a tremendous breadth of experience. Her guidance and advice are always most acute. And as Prime Minister, I was privileged to benefit from both enormously.
Amazing. It wasn't nerves after all about it being interviewed by Julian that led Margaret Thatcher to have a couple of stiff drinks, but the prospect of her weekly audience with the Queen. And probably the most remarkable story that Julian told me also involves the late Queen. It goes back to 1984, when the Battle of Orgreave saw a violent confrontation between striking miners in South Yorkshire and thousands of police officers from around the country.
During the miners' strike, you remember the occasional real flashpoints, and there was a famous event at Orgreave coking depot near Rotherham. Thatcher was determined to break the strike, and they got in as many as 8,000 pickets collected by Arthur Scargill to stop the lawyers going in and out of the depot with the coke. And 5,000 policemen from all over the country and a goodly number of mounted police who had nothing whatever to do with Rotherham, or Austin, as it were. And the Queen was watching this on telly. And when the horses went in and rode through some of the miners and knocked through down, the Queen said words to them, oh, that's awful. We didn't do that. And the Queen, at the height of the vexed strike, to make a political comment like that, was news. And Charlie Douglas Hume, my editor then, who had the most astonishing contacts, being related to the heir to the throne and being a Douglas Hume, told me one afternoon that he'd heard that the Queen at the dinner party the previous night had said this. Julian said, it's a good story, isn't it? I said, yes. You will stand it up for me and write it by 6. And I said, I think if you know the facts, you should write it yourself as a special correspondent or something. No, I can't do that. I said, you do it. I said, well, I'll come to the list. May not be that easy. And the rest of the day I spent trying to find out, and it turned out there were only 2 other people in the room when she said it. She had said it, and I felt absolutely firm. So I went back to Charlie. One was the Queen's private secretary, Robert Fellowes, and the other was George Younger, Secretary of State for Scotland, who I knew to be a friend of Charlie anyway. And anyway, I threw the story up beyond doubt. And I went back to Charlie and said, you perhaps ought to know before we go any further with this. So only 2 people heard that. Okay, he said, we'll drop it. I spent 6 hours sweating. I felt terribly pleased to have stood it up. It wasn't used.
Absolutely extraordinary. Julian Haviland telling about the story he couldn't publish. The Queen expressing a disapproval of the police action at Orgreave at the height of the miners' strike. But because there were only 2 people at the dinner, one of them a cabinet minister, one of them a private secretary to the Queen, if the story had been published, it would have been obvious who it had come from. Well, Julian retired from daily journalism in 1986.
I just left because I'd had enough. I'd been around Westminster stuff for 20 years, and I thought life must have something more to offer. And so it was.
And it really did. He and his family loved Scotland where they lived, and he went on to produce two books, and as recently as last year, wrote for The Times Red Box. Julian Haviland died on August the 11th at the age of 93, and I have to say it was a real privilege to be able to hear his reflections on being political editor of ITN and then political editor of The Times. I felt very lucky to be able to speak to him and to be able to bring you the interview today. And that's all we've got time for on today's episode of the podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes of The Political Editors. But for now, from me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.